Our gospel lesson for the morning comes from the 16th chapter of Luke, the first 13 verses. It's found in your pew Bible on page 1625. Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer.' The manager said to himself, 'What should I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses.' So he called in each one of his master's debtors. And he asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. And he asked a second, 'How much do you owe?' And he said, 1,000 bushels of wheat. He replied, 'Here, take your bill, make it 800. And the master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than the people of light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And who is ever dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." This is the word of the Lord. It was a hot summer afternoon in Lexington, Kentucky. I was sitting at the front desk of the Bosworth Memorial Library at Lexington Theological Seminary. We had joint privileges with the University of Kentucky's library across the street. And their faculty and their students could use our library and ours could use theirs. So a stranger, a man I didn't know, came in and he got some books and he wanted to know if he could check them out. He was not a University of Kentucky professor. He was actually from Washington and Lee. And he was visiting Kentucky as their Appalachian Scholars Program. And so being this person that was a little scared to make a decision, I called over the head librarian, Mr. Roscoe Mitchell Pearson, a man who was a brilliant theological librarian. Also quite a character. Any pastor who ever attended even one course at College of the Bible or Lexington Theological Seminary from 1949 to 1983 has a Roscoe story. And some of them are even true. So he comes over and asks, and he checks the IDs. He said, "Yeah, he can check them out." So he checks them out. And then Roscoe comes over. "What did he check out? What did he check out?" And I showed him the cards, and he said, "Those are the best books on papyrus that have ever been written." So when the guy came back the next time, Roscoe started talking to him and said, "You know, where are you?" He said, "Well, I'm working on translating something. Would you like to see it?" "Well, yeah." So the next day he brought in this 8.5 by 10 glossy black and white of a piece of papyrus, and where he had his notes, and it was something to the effect that I checked the guardhouse last night and all the prisoners were accounted for, or something like that. And Roscoe says, "Well, I've got a few little pieces of papyrus. Would you be interested in seeing them?" And Dr. Royce Morris said, "Yeah, I'd be interested." He said later, he always runs across people who have two or three little pieces that, you know, really aren't worth much. Roscoe goes back into his office. The official story is that this was being kept inside the library safe, and I'll stick to the story on that. But he came out with this brown paper sack, you know, the old grocery sacks, and he dumps out on my desk right in front of me this big pile of ancient papyri. Dr. Royce Morris's eyes pop. He starts sorting through it. First thing he said is, "Don't put it back in that paper sack. We've got something valuable here." They had actually gone through and tried to catalog all of the papyrus that is known to exist in the U.S. and had missed this. This was the largest find of papyrus in the U.S. that had been undocumented, the Lexington Papyri. And one little piece that was just extremely high quality. And he said that was what they called priestly paper. It was used for legal and religious purposes only. That was the first piece he translated. I saw the publication when he translated it. Interestingly enough, it was part of a deed where a woman was buying some property. We don't think about that happening back then, but we have the proof of it from Lexington Papyrus. The biggest piece was a piece of, I don't know, maybe 5-6 inches across the top and probably about 8-10 inches down the side, kind of a triangle piece. Very rough, very cheap papyri for its time. And there's scribbling all over it. And Dr. Roisman showed that to me and he said, this is a piece of Greek accounting. That what they do is they just write across a line what somebody owed. If they paid off some, they'd mark through it and write above it what they paid. If they got some more, they'd mark through that and write what it was. I tell you what, as a person who has had accounting classes, in fact, I even tutored accounting to other students when I was in college, that would have driven me crazy. I tell you, anybody that's worked in finance, banking, you know, accounting, you'd say, how on earth did they ever know what anybody actually owed? It's an amazing, like I say, it was just scribbling everywhere, but that was how they kept up with it. That's how the guy in this story gets away with what he does. It would be very easy for him. Like I say, today we've got all kinds of checks and balances and try to catch where anybody tries to embezzle something. But back then, it was extremely easy. And apparently, this guy may have already been doing that because he was accused of it. And then he finds this way of letting creditors off the hook. Now they owe him a favor. And he'll spend the rest of his life cashing in the favors from people. And the amazing part of the story is that his master said, wow, he finally did something smart. You know? His master thought it was a good move. Can you imagine that? Guy just stole from you. And you say, well, he was creative in stealing. That's good. Why? Let me tell you something. We live in a society like that. It was that way in Jesus' time. It's that way in our time. That people admire those people who can get away with breaking the law, who can be selfish and greedy and can get things. All of those, you know, call them titans of industry, the people who made America great, these people, these industrialists from the 19th century. And we just sort of ignore parts of their story. Like they get together and decide how much they were cutting everybody's wages. And if the people complained about having to work more for less, they brought in private detectives or even U.S. troops to shoot them and kill them if they complained. They thought it was okay for them to join with other business owners to conspire to raise prices, to lower wages. But they thought that if their workers banded together and asked to negotiate working conditions and wages, they thought that was an illegal conspiracy. Very anti-union for that. We forget about that. We admire them. People in our own time want to see that come back. People in our own time admire those who can lie and cheat and steal. If you've got narcissistic personality, that you only think about yourself, that you can't see further than the end of your own nose, that you have no regard for the truth at all, and that you're willing to tell anything as long as it benefits you, you can get quite far in our society today. You can be a head of business. You can be, you know, there's plenty of politicians on both parties that do that. We reward it. We actually reward people doing that. And then it sounds like Jesus said to do it, doesn't it? He said, make friends with your wealth, and they will welcome you into, and the literal translation here is they will welcome you into their eternal tents. Now, we all know what a tent is. It's a temporary structure you put up. How can you have a permanent temporary structure? This is an oxymoron. I'll give you two theories on this. Dr. Margie Ralph is a noted New Testament literary critical professor. And she says Jesus is using irony here to try to make his point. She said it's like when her daughter as a teenager came in and said, Mom, I want to get married to my boyfriend. And the mother said, oh, I thought you wanted to go to college. And she said, oh, I do. She said, your boyfriend will pay for it, huh? That kind of, yeah, stop and think about this kind of statement. That's what Jesus is doing. Make friends because they'll welcome you into eternal tents. They're going to do what? What kind of eternal tents? And where's that tent going to be pitched? If you make friends with the people that are headed to hell, you can join them there. That's what she says, he says. Give you a second theory that's exactly the polar opposite. And this is something great about Bible study. Here's two theories that are exactly polar opposite of each other, and both can be true at the same time. Only God can do that. Years ago, I was in a meeting, a conference on evangelism. And one of the speakers was an evangelist with the radio Bible class. It puts out a very good devotional book and does a lot of good ministry. And he was telling the story when he was giving this verse here and the way he saw it. He and another one of the evangelists from RBC were eating lunch. They had a burger and some fries and a Coke. Back then, that was about a $3, maybe $4 meal. Fancy restaurant, probably $4, you know. And when they got ready to leave, his friend took a $20 bill out, stuck it inside one of his tracks, and laid it on the table for a tip. And he said, $20 tip on a $4 meal? You know, what about stewardship? Man said, you know, I always leave these tracks. I sign it, put on there, if you have any questions, call me, and I put my personal phone number. He said, I get calls from people all over the country who pick up these things and call me. He said, but first, you got to get their attention. He said, if I just left the track, they would throw it in the trash. He said, but a $20 tip, that gets their attention. I was preaching on this one time, and there was a young lady sitting on the front row that I knew worked at one of the better seafood houses along the coast of North Carolina. And I asked her, is a $20 tip still a good tip? She said, it still gets your attention, let me tell you. You get their attention, that $20 bill. And then he leaves the tray. And the man said, talk about using your money to buy friends that will welcome you into eternity. He's using his money to reach people who will welcome him into heaven with him. That's what God wants us to do. Now, on the other hand, I have a friend, a chaplain in the U.S. Army, Major Robert Lyons. He and I served disciple churches close to each other in our early days in the ministry, got to be good friends. And I've run across him from time to time. When Michelle was in the Ashtabula County Medical Center, and I was in a waiting room waiting for her one time, there was a guy there with the U.S. Army cap on. So I asked him, where'd you serve? And he said he was stationed at Fort Stewart, Georgia. And I said, oh, I got a good friend. It's a chaplain down there, Robert Lyons. And he said, you know the major? And when his wife came out, he said, this guy knows Major Lyons. So I think this man must have had a good experience with that chaplain. But Robert told me that when he was going through Duke, he was waiting tables to raise money to pay for his education. This shocks people sometimes. It costs a lot of money to go to seminary and become a minister. One reason why every denomination right now is having minister shortages. There are people who say, what? They charge you for that? Doesn't the church pay for it all? Let me tell you something. Those are the same people that complain about the Thanksgiving offering when we give money to help pay for it. I'll put in the commercial right now. When we have Thanksgiving offering, that's where the money goes. And the more money that the churches provide, the less that people have to work for it. So some of us, you know, worked several jobs to get through, and some of us had good support from our families like I did, and some of us had good support from our home churches like I did, and some of us had scholarships to get through, but it takes a lot of money. And so he was working in Durham, North Carolina, waiting tables, And he said there's this group that come in and they would leave. You may have seen these things. It looks like a $10 bill. But when you open it up, it's only half a printed fake $10 bill. And inside it says, I'm not going to leave you any money as a tip. I'm going to give you a better tip. You need to get saved. You need to find Jesus. So rather than help a minister become a minister and become serve a church, they're telling them, you need to find Jesus. Those don't go over very well. And you can think for yourself, which one of those two things meets what Jesus says? The guy who put the $20 bill in the tract, or the one who gives you a fake $10 bill because you need to find Jesus? Jesus warned. It was that way in his time. It was that way in our time. It was even that way back in the Old Testament. Amos complained about it, you know. The people who said, when's the new moon festival over? When's the Sabbath over so I can get back to business? You know the type. This church service has been going for how long now? You know. However, today we can go one step further. We can actually conduct business over the internet with our smartphones even while we're in church. But it's that idea, you know. The religion is for show, but the money is where their emphasis was. Relatives would come to them, the wealthy ones, and say, you know, hey, we're having a rough time. We're having some financial problems. Will you help? And the rich ones say, sure. The way they help was sell them as slaves and pocket the money. And Amos called them out for it, and they didn't like it. They told him, you go back to wherever you came from. Quit saying this. But he said, God knows. You can complain all you want, but God knows what you're doing. That was the way it was in his time. See, the way it was in Jesus' time. The way it is in our time. In fact, we're probably living in times that are very, very similar to what Jesus' times were. It's an interesting challenge that we have. There are people out there who want to twist the words of the Bible and try to make it into something that is self-serving and the way that they can use it against people. And it's important that we as the church take a stand and say, no, this is what Jesus taught. And we are going to follow it. Because Jesus said, you can't serve God, and the word he used there was mammon. It's translated money. But mammon was actually the Canaanite god of greed. The Canaanites were the original god, greed is good people. They actually had an idol. They had a god just for greediness. And there's still people who serve that greed. And say, you know, greed is good. You hear it said. They don't like churches coming up and say, well, the Apostle Paul said the love of money is the roots of all kinds of evil. They don't like it that Jesus said you can't serve your greed and Jesus at the same time. You're going to do one or the other. You know, people think hypocrisy is people who don't act out what they believe. That's impossible. You will act out what you believe. Hypocrisy is saying you believe something different than how you actually act. And there's a lot of it. It's who do you pick? Jesus puts it on the line. There's one or the other. You're either going to follow him or you're going to follow the ways of the world. And the ways of the world lead straight downhill in more ways than one. Do you choose to follow him who was lifted up on a cross for you, lifted up into ascension to heaven for you? Our choice is one that we have to make. Not just today. It affects our whole lives. Everything that we do. We have to be deciding, who am I following? Am I going the way my society expects us to? The way people want me to? The way my generation expects me to? Jesus called his generation all kinds of bad names. I'd hate to think what he says about my generation. Because we're being pulled that way. It's real. The question is, who do you choose to follow? You know, Joshua in the Old Testament, when they entered the promised land, He called the people together and he said, "Who do you choose to follow?" He said, "As for me and my house, we choose to follow the Lord." That saying, "Me and my house, we choose to follow the Lord," is on stuff all over my house. It's what we decide. It's what we all have to decide. Who do we choose? Who do we follow? The gods, little g, of this world, who think that they are greedy with a capital G? Or do we choose to follow Jesus Christ? Because Jesus Christ gave it all for you. And then see if we'll give it all for him. And the choice is ours. It's your choice every day of your life. Who am I following? Where am I going? Who do I believe in? Am I going to follow Jesus or go the other way? And he leaves that choice up to you.